go up, 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 up. Straight to the moon we two, high in the starry blue. I'll be out of this world with you.
Here we go, just a minute. Oh, wait. I'm telling you to wait. You're the audience, right? Wait. This is an order. Wait. Oh, electronics, how wonderful they are. It's Radio Misterioso.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Misterioso?
Okay, it's Radio Misterioso, and we are, if we are lucky, we are here with Nick Redfern. Just let me plug it in here.
Rick?
There. Nick, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, excellent. What great sound out of this computer. Nick has been on the show. Nick Redfern has been on the show many times before. His book that we're going to talk about, Final Events, has been out for quite a while, I guess. How long, Nick? About 6 months or something?
Yeah, it's been out since about September last year, I think it was published. So 7 months, something like that.
And I just got around to finishing it, or mostly
finished. No, I'm like that with books as well. So no.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's not for lack of the book being not interesting. As I read more of the book, I was, I don't know about equal parts, but I was delighted and envious and admiring of what Nick has uncovered in it. Because there's a lot of stuff that we've talked about on this show and talked about ourselves, and I've talked about with other people, that is impinged upon by the subject matter and the people that Nick interviewed for this book, Final Events, which turned out to be far more fascinating than I had first expected when I started reading the book. And just got in the very bare bones beginning of it. When I started it, Nick, I thought it sounded like just a bunch of fundamentalist Christians who were going nuts somewhere in the government. As I got further, I realized it was a lot more than that. So maybe you could explain.
Well, that is part of it. That's certainly part of it. But, you know, I mean, the book, you know, it deals with a group in the government, as you know, a think tank type group, that was funded to look into the UFO issue and came to the conclusion that it was quite literally demonic. Now, you know, people ask me, to what extent is this significant? You know, it's kind of like, well, if you throw money at a group to investigate something, they're going to come to a conclusion. If it's a conclusion that is largely based upon the beliefs or the prejudices of the group in question, how valid is it? Or equally, is it a valid story purely because the government's funding somebody to investigate this angle? Do you see what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's a fascinating story, but to what extent the story has validity in terms of the conclusions of the group, you know, or is it just an interesting story because it happens to be not just a belief system that many people in the UFO field hold, which actually do, but it's actually a view held by the government, or people in the government, you know. It's kind of like how you look at the significance of the story or not, I guess.
Well, if people, I'm going to do the lazy host thing And I know you've done this hundreds of times, but maybe describe, and you can be free about what you want to say about. The other thing is, if there are things, is there anything in the book that you don't want to talk about on the show that you want to leave kind of up to people reading the book? I didn't figure.
No, I mean, you know. No, I mean, you know, the way I look at it, if I put something in a book, it's fair game for discussion, you know. The only time, I never leave stuff out because I think it's controversial, because, you know, I think that's sort of a, that's the wrong thing to do, you know. It's, I think the only time I leave information out is if, say, for example, it's just from one source and it's so far out that it's not, you know, sort of backed up by anybody else and, well, you know, then I'd leave that sort of stuff out. But for the most part, you know, I think if you're going to tell a story, tell the story. And if you're going to write about it, then all bets are off as far as discussing it. So, no, I don't care.
What I meant about the lazy host thing is, why don't you describe, and I know you've done this many times before, but describe what this group is, the Collins Elite, maybe a little bit of a history of them and what their aims were. And then I've got about 15, 20 questions that I pounded out over the last few days here.
All right, cool. Well, before I sort of get to what the group believes and who it is, et cetera, it's probably a good point to, you know, to make as to how I got involved with this story.
Yeah, that's one of my questions, too.
Okay, good. Well, I'm sure, you know, you recognize yourself that unless you're really lucky doing any sort of journalistic story, whether it's UFOs or whatever, it rarely just falls in your lap. You know, it's one of these things, if that happens, it's not that it's too good to be true, it's just that unfortunately it just doesn't happen that often. And certainly, you know, final events was no different. What actually happened was that somewhere in the region about 4.5-5 years ago, the first time I made contact with a man named Ray Beauchesne. And Ray has sort of an interesting background, because on the one hand he's an Anglican priest, but on the other hand he's a former MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, state director. He's a former state director for the state of Nebraska. And I was actually doing some research on the Rendlesham Forest case probably about 5 or 6 years ago, with a view to looking at it from the perspective that, you know, could it have been some sort of weird psyop, you know, to sort of test military personnel reactions when exposed to perceived abnormal phenomena. And one of the people who'd commented on this was Ray. Ray was actually quoted in one of Jenny Randall's books called UFO Landing, Friend or Foe, I think it was called, about 12 or 13 years ago. And in that book, Ray talked about how he'd supposedly been told by a couple of Department of Defense guys, or was told, I should say, that Rendlesham was like a staged event using some sort of sophisticated hologram technology. Now, whether that's, you know, whether Ray was being told the truth or not, that's one big question. The other big question is, you know, well, who were these guys? Where did they get the story from? So I tracked Ray down and phoned him up and said, hey, you know, this is interesting. I'm researching this further. And what Ray basically said was, well, you know, this is just a small part of what they told me. My first impression was that, you know, that the meeting that he had with these guys from the Pentagon was about Rendlesham. It actually wasn't. That was just sort of a minor aside to a bigger story. What basically happened was that in 1991, Ray was approached by two guys, two physicists, whose background, I should stress, he was able to verify. And they were working, they said, on a Pentagon-funded project, or DOD-funded project, to investigate aspects of the UFO phenomenon. It wasn't a case of, you know, studying radar reports and photographs to try and determine what these were. It was almost like an offshoot of the whole remote viewing program of the 70s. And what the plan was to try and contact and exploit or utilize or understand the so-called extraordinary mental powers of what in popular lore and ufology become known as the Greys. And the idea was to have, like, as I said, a follow-on version of the remote viewing program where perhaps psychic spies, our spies, could use or understand the sort of what were perceived as like the extraordinary mental skills of the Greys and used them as like a tool of warfare and espionage or even assassination. You know, if the, in other words, if the Greys could render people while they're in bed at night into like a semi-conscious state and transfer them to a UFO and wipe their memory clean, etc., if we could utilize that technology, we would have a hell of a weapon. And that was the plan. It was sort of like taking remote viewing to the next stage, but with the help of the intelligence behind the UFOs. And it's not actually clear, and I actually think, from what I was told, you know, the group didn't physically contact these entities. It was a kind of a case of psychic spies using their minds to contact what we would call, or what a lot of people would call aliens, but what this group referred to as NHEs, which stood for non-human intelligence. Excuse me, NHEs, NHIs, I'm sorry, non-human intelligences.
Oh, okay.
And so that was the plan. And Ray said, or Ray was told, that they actually did have some success, you know, using this sort of mind power to connect with these entities. Which identified themselves as some sort of extraterrestrial beings. And Ray was told that the further and further they got into the project, that although they had some successes, they also had a lot of failures. There were some deaths on the project. And it was kind of like going to work each day and going in this particular set of labs or whatever. And it was almost like entering a haunted house where people talk about, you know, this weird ominous atmosphere that, you know, you can almost cut with a knife, but you don't really know what it is and you can't see it. But it was just this imposing feeling of like a dark cloud hanging over everything. And some of the people, as I said, died. Some got sick mentally and physically. And they came to believe that these entities, these non-human intelligences, were quite literally sort of deceptive, demonic entities masquerading as extraterrestrials. And the reason being to further get their sort of claws and grips into us by presenting themselves as alien. And the two guys that Ray met, Ray quite legitimately asked, you know, well, why are you speaking to me? What can I do for you? You know, I'm not on the project. And it was basically because Ray had a background in the Christian church and also as a MUFON state director, they wanted his opinion on whether he thought they were on the right track by actually thinking these entities weren't extraterrestrial, but they were some sort of negative, hostile, malevolent force, you know. And he said, well, I actually do think that. I think, you know, there is evidence that the UFO phenomenon is sort of it represents, you know, the battle between good and evil, if you like. And so Ray told me this story about how he had various sort of clandestine meetings with what you can only sort of describe as like ufological deep throats. They occurred at a place called the Cornhusker Hotel in Nebraska, in Lincoln, Nebraska, on several occasions. And there were follow-up meetings, phone calls, letters, etc. And, of course, when Ray told me this, he said, as I pointed out in the book, you know, there were a couple of things he asked me not to publish, which I didn't, which related to the way in which these guys got in contact with him. And it was these things that I was asked not to publish that allowed me to sort of contact some of these people further who were linked with this program called the Collins Elite. Now, that sort of background is how I got into it. And it was then a case of when I'd sort of had this, got this inroad from Ray and a few details, which, as I said, I agreed not to publish, that allowed me to track further people down.
Is that because you had information that they thought that these further contacts thought that you shouldn't know, or that if you had the information, that was your key to kind of talking to them and knowing that you were sincere about it?
Yes, I had a few names and places and installations that were reportedly involved and contacted a couple of them and phoned a couple of people with the names that I had.
You need keys with these people. It's seems to be, I'm sure you've found that.
It's what, sorry?
You need keys with these kinds of people.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't a case, you know, it wasn't a case of here's the name and the address, etc. You know, it was a case of me looking for them. And then what happened on a couple of occasions, it was I got a response back, why are you looking for me? You know, along those lines.
Yeah.
And then realizing you've hit the right person and they were willing to listen. And, you know, I legitimately pointed out or explained that, you know, I'd spoken to Ray Beauchamp. Ray had told me this particular story, this group in the Pentagon, which is a fascinating story, and I'd like to dig into it further. And some of them said, you know, I'm not interested in talking. Actually, I think I interviewed altogether something like 13 people, got the finger, basically, the middle finger from six or seven, and out of the 13 I interviewed, I think eight or nine allowed me to quote them, and the one or two actually allowed me to, but who I didn't, because they didn't really offer anything new. It was just a little bit of corroboration where they were just repeating small snippets of what somebody else said. So in other words, you know, it was sort of a detective game, tracking people down and interviewing them. But the upshot that I got was that this group, the Collins Elite, now the important thing to note is that the people who told me that it was called the Collins Elite, all of them said this is a nickname. Now, I could not get a straight answer as to whether or not there was actually a real name as well. Now, I suspect there was, but what I also suspect, although I have to admit I have no proof of this at all, this is literally my speculation, I speculate that because everyone was careful to say, tell me what the nickname was, in the same way, you know, people, the nickname of the CIA is the company, you know, it's kind of like that, but the CIA is its real name. And so what I suspect is that possibly that the nickname the Collins Elite was used in case, if I'd got hold of the real name, and then people started using the Freedom of Information Act for information on that group, that might actually open problematic doors for certain people.
Yeah.
But if you've got a nickname, you know, an agency can legitimately say there is no group or think tank in the government by the name of the Collins Elite.
Yeah.
But it was a nickname. But apparently the group, to some degree, went back even to the late 40s, early 50s. Now, although that sounds astonishing that it could stay hidden for so long, a lot of people have said, well, how could like an agency like the CIA or whatever hide for that long? And which what I've consistently had to point out, and granted, you know, to people who haven't read the book, so it's not their fault, is that this isn't an official agency as such. It's like a small, we might be talking 30, 40 people, think tank group funded basically and set, told, you know, here's your rooms, this is where you work from, here's X hundred thousands of dollars per year, please research this particular angle for us and prepare reports. And these people had regular jobs and were still paid through their regular jobs, but were sort of siphoned off to work on side projects, many of which dealt in the initial years to sort of occult areas rather than purely Christian belief systems. 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, they were looking at people like Jack Parsons, Aleister Crowley, things like that. By the 80s, it had sort of gone into, well, no, this is just a straightforward battle for our souls between, you know, the devil and God, literally. And in more recent years, and far more disturbingly, it's almost like the group's been hijacked by a fundamentalist approach that we know the best, and we know best, and you know, we know what's good for the country, and we need to sort of integrate religion more, literally come hell or high water, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's mutated over the years. And to me, that sounds, you know, people say, well, do you think you were disinformed? If I was disinformed, I think it would have been such a far grander story than, well, we're just a think tank of guys who somebody pumped money into. You know, it would have been far more you know, significant in terms of trying to lure me in. Wow, this is like some MJ-12 group, which actually isn't, you know. And I think also, you know, the subtle changes over the years is, to me, suggestive of reality, you know, because people change. People's views change. It's like with the whole MJ-12 thing. It doesn't matter if the documents are from the 40s or the present day. Nothing's changed. You know, it's just nuts and bolts crap. They're coming here, etc. I think it is more plausible when you have a group like this where over the course of 50 years, attitudes to things change. That sounds to me more believable than your average sort of disinfo ploy, if you like.
Yeah. So,
but that's what, essentially the group, like the think tank groups.
So how did you develop these? Oh, you did actually describe how you developed the contacts. Well, how about
basically,
really specific about probably, I guess, the one that would seem the weirdest or the most clandestine to you? This doctor that you met that lived in a dirty house somewhere in the Southwest?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things I know, you know, I'm sure you've found when you've been doing your your project, I'm going to say it, I should say it, Beta. Your Project Beta book. That's my English accent if people don't understand.
Project Aluminium.
Greg can say properly American way. Go on.
Project Aluminium. I mean Beta.
Project Beta. There you go. Beta. Well, anyway, Project Beta, Project Beta. Everyone to title it. You know, I mean, you know yourself doing the research for that. When you sort of get into the realm of speaking with intelligence people and military intelligence, etc., it is sort of a weird world. And you either, you know, intimidate some people or you take the bull by the horns and you phone them up or you send a letter and you track them down and you speak to them. And, you know, if you're going to get the story, that's what you have to do. There's nothing, you know, nothing worse than being some sort of quaking fool and, oh, you know, what happens if I phone them? What if? Well, no, you know, if you said what if, you'd never do anything in life.
Do you get what ifs from people? Like, my wife would do this, and my parents are like, oh, wow, you better be careful, you know, they're going to do. But the thing is, it's like, it's that thing that few people, including Bill Moore, told me, is you play the game, and you play it for what you can get, and if you don't play the game, you get nothing.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's like anything in life, you know. It's like, well, what if I take driving lessons and I crash the car? Well, then you'll never learn to drive a car, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that same sort of scenario. But, I mean, with all these people, really, it was kind of like a cloak and dagger scenario saying, hey, you know, after the first one or two contacts where they would give me other contacts, it was along the lines of, hey, you know, this person, my name's Nick Redfern, I'm researching this group. Mr. So-and-so gave me your name and your number and said you might be willing to speak. He said you were involved, you know, back in the 60s. And some of them were like, well, yeah, okay, all right. Others were like, well, you know, who the hell is he to sort of give my contact details out to you? You know, why didn't he ask me first? And the phone goes down. And it was sort of, you know, and other responses were somewhere in between those.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a case of go away or, yes, I'll spill the beans. You know, it was never that simplistic. And again, you know, to me that's more in line with real life. You know, it wasn't like somebody was just feeding all this material. Some of them just said, no, you know, I'd rather not talk. But now the one you're on about, this is probably the strangest situation I've ever actually been in. This involves a man who was identified himself as a Dr. Mandor, who was actually reportedly the only non-American within the group itself. And this was sort of, Without doubt at all, you know, the very weirdest, as I said, situation I've ever been involved in. And he was a guy who was supposedly involved with the Collins elite in the early 1980s. And his role was in respect to an alien abduction investigative project that went on within the Collins elite in the early 80s during the Reagan administration. And there were reportedly three projects, if you like, or three reports prepared for the Reagan administration on abductions. One of the Collins elite, which said it's demonic. Another one, which was sort of a scientific and technical office of the CIA, suggested it was extraterrestrial. And then apparently they had an Air Force psychologist who looked at all the issues like sleep paralysis and things like that and said, you know, we think it's psychological. So in other words, you have various people looking into this. And, you know, this is one of the interesting areas was the Collins elite's view and this guy, Dr. Mandor, that he said that, well, you know, we investigated this and we were asked to prepare a report, which is fair enough, but what was sort of stranger was not so much the story, but this guy himself, Dr. Mandor. I had a very weird set of circumstances where this meeting went ahead in Denver in a rented room, which, you know, not even going to somebody's address where you could verify it in, you know, the Yellow Pages or whatever. It was literally a rented room, which I think had been rented for quite some time, purely and simply because, I know it's not rented now, but it was rented for some time, because it wasn't just like, you know, it contained furniture that anybody you know, if you moved in and then somebody else moved in, it was the same furniture. You know, there were paintings and statues and little figurines around the walls, all relative to jinns, you know, Middle Eastern jinn folklore, etc. And he was obsessed with jinns. But he had a background in Middle Eastern religion. Now, he was actually brought into the project purely and simply for this reason, because they were viewing parallels between sort of jinn folklore and mythology and the sort of purported powers and goals of the Greys. And he essentially concluded, well, you know, these things are all one and the same. If you somebody puts a Christian spin on it, somebody puts a jinn spin on it, somebody puts an alien spin on it, whatever they actually are, they're all one and the same. But yeah, he was a very weird character. The best way I can describe him was sort of, well, I described him in the book. He's like 5'2", very oily, slick back hair, elderly, sort of white, putty-looking skin. Kind of like a, I don't know, kind of like a sick-looking Henry Kissinger or something like that. It's probably the best way to describe him. And very... this is difficult to explain, but kind of like an unsettling feeling from him. I almost got a weird, a kind of feeling where you get from a dog when it's about to bite. That's the best way I can describe it. It was kind of like an ominous, disturbing, unsettling feeling when you were sat opposite him. And I actually had one email from somebody, well, actually a series of exchanges of emails with somebody who had read the book and actually felt that Mandor himself was some sort of paranormal entity. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but that's what they said. You know, they said they'd studied, you know, religious materials for years, and they felt this was some sort of, he was some sort of demonic entity, which was bizarre, you know, to, you know, if I had you answer an email like that, I just, you know.
Yeah, you don't
very
know.
Interesting. It's very interesting, but it's like he was, excuse me, he was an extremely disturbing character. I mean, that's the only thing I can say. It was kind of like being in a room with someone who was, you know, I don't know. I'm actually stuck for words, you know, other than to say he was a very disturbing character, and he exuded a kind of feeling of menace almost.
Huh.
Even, you know, like he never took his eyes off you. And I mean, literally, you know, his eyes were locked on me constantly, as if he was almost sort of judging.
Yeah. I had one of those. Yeah, I had somebody sort of like that, but it's funny. It's only during part, after we finished talking about everything, he suddenly started telling me about some sort of mind control experiment that had been going on for a long time that used Greek letters as code to turn on like control on people's minds or something like that. I don't know where that came. He came out of left field with it, and I didn't know if it was a test on me or what. But he got very fidgety and agitated and worried and looking around like he hadn't before when he was started talking about this. And at that point, you don't know, like you said, you don't know where that's coming from. Are you making that up?
Right,
is that the guy? Is that, you know, is this some sort of a test? You know, did you get that feeling that somebody was testing you occasionally?
Well, I mean, the only circumstance under which I could say it was a test was that one I just mentioned too, where it was kind of like I did get the feeling that every response he made, he was judging my reaction.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, it wasn't just a case of giving me the reply. I mean, he didn't. He only offered one piece of information. Everything that he talked about was in response to my questions. The one piece of information, which is quite extensive, which he brought up, which was sort of really weird. You know, people talk all about these secret groups watching abductees, you know, and, you know, they take sort of the MILABs, you know, the military abductions, where they take abductees to underground bases and question them, and they're flying helicopters over people's homes and, you know, watching them, etc., if you've been abducted. Well, he said that was all nonsense. He said there is no such thing as a physical flesh and blood abduction. He said every single abduction ever reported occurs in like a visionary state in the brain, but he said it's not due to hallucination, anything like that, or bad dreams. He said it's these entities having the ability to interact with the human mind. And the reason is to, I guess, sort of instill abduction imagery, almost as like a meme, to spread it through throughout culture and society, the idea that aliens are abducting us, but it's really to sort of get their claws into us and believe we're dealing with aliens for the day when they launch some ultimate deception. And where it got really weird, he said that all these stories also about underground bases, people taken to underground bases and seeing helicopters flying over their homes, he said that's all nonsense. He said all these stories about abductees being taken to alien bases are kind of like abductions. It's like a sophisticated hologram, not kind of like a, you know, an image where you're just dreaming it, but it's almost like a created hologram that you interact with somehow.
Oh, well, that, I was going to say that explains people taking pictures of the helicopters.
Well, yeah, exactly. But he said, yeah, but he said the helicopters are kind of like stage-crafted holographic imagery that the human mind has the ability to interact with. In other words, he said that these, what we would call the greys, what he would call demons or jinns, whatever, have the ability to instill human, to instill holographic imagery in the human mind, which the human mind then projects outwardly, but the human mind projects it outwardly in a fashion that it can relate to. In other words, the hologram, although it's a hologram, its appearance is dictated by the way we interpret it. It's like the hologram can interact with us. It's not just like a, you know, somebody fires a hologram of a star, you know, or a square or a circle on a cloud. We actually influence how it appears. And he said that the entire abduction, underground base, black helicopter issue is entirely holographic, which, you know, is sort of strange.
Well, the way he's describing, it's not only holographic, but it's in some way recursively psychotronic. Recursively, I mean, reacting to somebody's reactions to it, and psychotronic meaning it's a technology that uses the human mind as something that affects the human mind through some sort of technological apparatus or projection or whatever you want to call it. Which is funny that they say that. It's funny that they say that because I keep pushing this thing that, and you do too, that these whatever's going on is we routinely ignore our contribution to it.
Mm. No, you're right. I mean, you know, I think Mandor, to his credit at least, wasn't trying to push totally that, you know, the God versus devil scenario. He pointed out that, you know, because of his interest with djinns and things like that, that this was a case of something is interacting with us, and the group, he personally didn't think it was positive or, you know, something that was sort of friendly to us, and it was manipulative, and he felt that, you know, the entire thing was, as I said, holographic, but not just to deceive us, but to spread so many stories and to, you know, sort of quasi-abduct so many people, purely, as I said, to spread like a meme, where society would understand after only a few years of what the concept of what alien abduction was and is. And he actually said something which I found was kind of interesting, that certain people were chosen because of their ability to get the story out there. You know, and you have to wonder about people like, for example, Whitley Strieber. You know, was Whitley chosen because he was already a best-selling author? You know, it's like, why abduct John Smith if John Smith doesn't have the ability to do anything with the story? You know, I think that's an interesting angle as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's... but the thing, you know, the first question that comes up after he says, well, all this is due to some sort of technology and people wanting... somebody wanting to think that. Who? Who wants us to think that? According to that one guy you talked... Mandel, that you talked to.
Who wants us to believe it's extraterrestrial and we're being abducted, you mean?
Yeah, according to him. I know the Collins Elite. We'll get to that, too. But I'm still on about, as you say, this strange man in Denver.
No, his view, his entire view, and this was part of the story that was put out, or not story put out, but in the report prepared for the Reagan administration in 82, apparently, or 83. The whole purpose of these entities doing it was them doing it. And the reason they wanted to do it, the reason they were sort of instilling in people's minds the imagery of abductions, etc., underground bases and helicopters, was to reinforce and build on the idea that people would understand that we were being abducted by aliens. And the plan, as the group saw it and as he saw it, was that one day these entities will show themselves en masse at a time when we've all become acclimatized to what abductions are and what it means, and we will be the victims of their deception, because, you know, just landing and saying we're aliens or whatever, you know, from out the blue, would people listen? If there's like a cultural meme that's been around for 30 years, and then they land and say we're the aliens and we're here to help you and we've been abducting you, etc., then, you know, his view was a considerable amount of people might listen because they would know all about abduction law. But he came to, again, to the view that, you know, this was being done to deceive us, essentially as a battle for our souls. I mean, that was literally how he saw it. But this was sort of the early sort of, you know, the ground troops doing the groundwork, you know, preparing the latter-day situation. But for the early stage, you know, they had to sort of manipulate us to get their claws into us and pretend to be something they're actually not. And then further down the line, you know, they'll show themselves and a significant number of the population will come over to their side and want their help or whatever, you know, yeah, save the planet, whatever. And that's how he saw it. It was sort of like a step-by-step process to convince us extraterrestrials are amongst us and abductions are a part of their agenda, etc.
All right. Did you ever, the first question that comes to my mind when you say that is, did you ever ask any of them why it took so damned long? Like thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and they still haven't been able to do anything about it? Or they just, now is the time, or what? Why is now different than 2,000 years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I can tell you is that in the early days, now, this is why there's a distinct difference between what the group believed or concluded in, say, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and what they conclude today. If I start with the latter-day thing, we're basically talking about they believe that regardless of when these entities started, the exact date has already been prophesied and dictated according to the teachings of the Bible or whatever. You know, in other words, it doesn't matter what these entities try and do now or in the 80s, 90s, or in, you know, 2050 or whatever, it's all predetermined anyway, according to God's will. That's how they see it. However, 50, 40 years ago, their views were very different. They concluded that people like Aleister Crowley, doing things like the Alamantra working, and then Jack Parsons with things like the Babylon working in 1946, were opening portals that allowed these entities, not allowed them in, because he said they were already here, but opened the doorways to allow more of these entities in to influence us. And so, in other words, it was more along the lines of from the 20th century onwards that these things have had a further grip on us, because people have allowed them to. Doorways and portals have been opened, and that has allowed them to sort of further instill their control or attempted control over us. Today, that isn't what most of the group think. They really do believe that, you know, the time scale, it doesn't matter what was going on 2,000 years ago, they couldn't have taken over 2,000 years ago because it's not part of the predetermined plan, if you like. So.
Oh, I see. So it's just explained by because it is written, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the most important points I've spelled out to people, you know, when I'm talking about the book, is that what we have to remember is that although in its early years, I think the most significant part of the group's existence is its early years, because it's quite clear from the people I spoke to, they were very open-minded back then. They were looking at all the theories, and they were coming to an alternative for the ETH, which did involve people like Parsons, Crowley, altered states of mind, you know, ingesting various chemicals and substances, etc., you know, to open your mind to other realms of existence. They were looking at all that and determining that however you define the paranormal, the supernatural, or the occult, however you define them, that's where these entities originated from. And, you know, they were quite open-minded. But you're quite right when you said, you know, it's all according to the written word. That is where they're at today. They kind of, something happened, as far as I can tell. I mean, and again, I have to admit that because, you know, I've interviewed, well, for the book, by the time of writing the book, you know, as I said, probably 15, 16 people. I've interviewed a few more since the book, so it's probably up to about 24, covering the late 40s to the present day. Now, for all I don't think it's a massive group. In fact, I'm sure it isn't. But if it, over the entire existence, maybe there's been 100 people, to interview sort of 20 out of 100, it's only going to give you a certain insight. In other words, it's kind of like trying to write a book on the CIA by interviewing 20 retired agents or whatever. You're only going to get a certain insight from their own perspective. And I think that's the same here, that when you talk about them today believing this or believing that because it's written in a book, that is the, that's the biggest problem or mistake they've made, is that kind of throwing out every other scenario or theory beyond the Christian one, and a particularly like a fundamentalist Christian one.
Yeah.
That they know that this is what it is. And something, as far as I can tell, that sort of belief system really didn't come into play until some point in the 80s. Before that, it was sort of very much, well, you know, we don't think this is extraterrestrial, it's weirder. But well, some, it's almost like something got their grips into, or a group did, you know, there, were more, there was more of like a religious grip was placed on it to where, you know, we're seeing, like, for example, today, there's more and more manipulation to get religion into the military. You know, there's that, if you, you can find that on the internet, there's absolutely no doubt about that, that there are certain people in the military who want the sort of the war in the Middle East to be perceived as not a war against terrorists, but a religious crusade against good and evil. You know, they want the troops to be seen as religious crusaders, which they're not. They're soldiers fighting a war in the same way in the Second World War. They were soldiers fighting Hitler. It wasn't a battle between, you know, good and evil in terms of biblical perspectives or whatever.
Yeah, well, it kind of turned out that way in the public's mind. Well, the public's mind on either side, I suppose. You say the early days. I don't think we went into the inception of the group and why it was formed. Okay. And how big the group was at the beginning, things like that. If you're tuning in, or whatever you want to call it now, Nick Redfern's talking about his book Final Events, which is a story of a clandestine group within the U.S. government that that basically believe that what we know as UFO entities are actually demons or malevolent spirits that are here to steal our souls. Am I right, Nick?
Yeah, pretty much. They actually, I mean, I'll get back to the beginnings in a minute, but yeah, their view is that the human soul contains a form of energy, which, you know, in essence, they're farming us, is the way what the group concluded. They're farming us upon death and extracting the life source, if you like. But we can talk about that in a while, you know, trying to get more into that. But so people don't sort of get confused. As far as I've been able to tell, and this is, again, you know, granted from interviewing 10, 15 people definitely connected to the group and with verifiable links to the intelligence community and the military, is that in the late 40s, what basically happened, it's sort of a long and weird story, but I'll condense it as much as I can and simplify it. But what happened was that all the people who made up the original Collins elite were people who were actually involved prior to the setting up of the group in another issue, and this related to Jack Parsons. Now, Jack Parsons was a brilliant, as you know, rocket pioneer who sort of straddled two very different areas with great ease, one of them being early rocketry and the other one being the realm of the occult. And he was somebody who was actually a disciple and a close working colleague and even a friend to a degree with none other than Aleister Crowley. Now, back in 1918, Crowley had embarked upon this thing called the Amalantra Working, where basically in a state of an altered state via mescaline and hashish, interacted or conjured up or opened a portal, however you want to determine it, to this creature known as Lam. And if you see Crowley's pictures of Lamb, it looks almost, apart from the black eyes, it looks almost like the creature on the cover of Whitley Strieber's Communion. So in other words, Crowley was someone who possibly opened a doorway to some sort of, in simple terms, interdimensional entity. Well, Jack Parsons was fascinated with Crowley's work and his world, and you know, he began working closer and closer with him. Then in 1946, Parsons himself embarked upon this thing called the Babylon Working, which again, the idea was to try and conjure up like an elemental being, if you like. Now, because Parsons' work in that area was fine, you know, that wasn't bothering anyone, but because he was a very well-respected and brilliant, albeit alternative, rocket scientist, he was actually, you know, sort of someone who was becoming more and more closely tied with the military. The military was realizing that rocketry was going to be sort of a burgeoning area of research and as a weapon, you know, in years ahead. And so the military was, on the one hand, torn between the fact that they knew they needed to get Parsons on board to, you know, help them with their rocket research, but equally, it was somebody who, you know, before rocket launches, would try and invoke the god Pan to ensure a successful rocket launch. And they kind of turned a blind eye and said, well, you know, we think he's a bit of a weirdo, but he's a hell of a good rocket scientist, so let's get him on board. And so, you know, that was what happened. But in the late 40s, Parsons got into big trouble when he actually took a bunch of documents from his workplace when he was doing contract work with the military. He took a bunch of documents, and the plan was to provide them to the then new State of Israel, who were also working on their early own rocket programs. And there was deep concern on the part of the Air Force, Navy, and Army that Parsons had stolen these documents, basically as an undercover espionage agent, to sell them to the Israelis. Parsons claimed, no, that's nonsense. You know, he said, I wanted to get a job with them. They offered me a position. And instead, in his position, or excuse me, from his perspective, he said, instead of writing out a resume, he thought, I'll just take a bunch of documents and show them what I was working on. Now, it's sort of a murky area to this day as to whether or not he was sort of some Israeli undercover agent, or whether he was just someone who had an alternative view on a lot of things, including how to get a job. You know, instead of writing a resume, he's like, I'll just take a bunch of documents from the office safe and show them what I'm working on. You know, you could look at it both ways. But what happened was that you had various people from Army intelligence, Naval intelligence, Air Force intelligence, the CIA, FBI, and the State Department all involved in this investigation, looking into Parsons' background. And many of the people involved were some of the people who made up the original incarnation of the Collins Elite. That what was happening was, because this was sort of a multi-agency investigation, some of the agencies actually interacted with each other, sharing data and files and things like that. And the upshot was to determine who Parsons was, you know, in terms of his character and what he was doing, and et cetera. A lot of background research was undertaken into not just Parsons the rocket scientist, but Parsons the man and Parsons the occultist. And so, in other words, you had like two or three people assigned to the investigation from seven or eight agencies. Sort of, you know, you're talking about an interagency investigation of 20 or 30 people. And the final conclusion was, well, the guy was just like he was just reckless. You know, he shouldn't have taken the files, and he got fired. But you know, we don't think he actually is an espionage agent. But what happened was that during the course of investigating Parsons' background as a person, as an occultist, they found that he had a number of intriguing links. One was the fact that he was friends, for a while at least, with L. Ron Hubbard, who, of course, you know, formed the Church of Scientology, and they actually worked together on this Babylon Working. Well, Hubbard wrote science fiction. He was also well known to Ray Palmer, who edited the Amazing Stories science fiction magazine, so the legendary sci-fi publication. And Ray Palmer co-authored with Kenneth Arnold The Coming of the Flying Saucers, Kenneth Arnold being the guy who essentially ushered in the era of flying saucers in the summer of 47. And now, according to witness testimony, the people I interviewed, because there was this connection between Palmer and Hubbard, Hubbard and Parsons, and Palmer and Arnold, that Parsons and Arnold actually supposedly met on a couple of occasions. So in other words, you have this guy, Parsons, linked with Crowley, who opened the doorway to this communion-type entity. And yep. then we find that Parsons actually met Kenneth Arnold, the man who ushered in the era of flying saucers, only 12 months after Parsons supposedly opened yet another portal with the Babylon working. And so they thought, well, that's interesting. You know, this guy Parsons, you know, he's somebody tied in with Kenneth Arnold, this guy who just recently, like a year or so ago, said he saw one of these new weird things called a flying saucer or a group of flying saucers. The more they dug into it, these people began to sort of have, when the program finished even, they were fascinated by Parsons as an individual and started having meetings after work, you know, as one of them told me, like, they'd have martinis together or whatever, you know, in some bar or whatever, in or restaurants in D.C., where a lot of them worked. And, you know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And they started digging more into Parsons and the whole UFO thing and began looking at parallels, for example, like George Hunt Williamson, one of the early contactees in the same era. You know, he made a lot of his contacts, supposedly, via Ouija board. George Adamski, on his first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, his co-author, Desmond Leslie, well, Desmond Leslie's father, Sir Shane Leslie, was like a disciple of Aleister Crowley. So they were looking at all these early occult-based links and thinking, well, hang on, you know, is it only coincidence that people like Hunt Williamson and Adamski have these sort of occult ties, etc., to the UFO theme, and then Parsons is somehow linked with Kenneth Arnold? You know, what does all this mean? And it was a case then of then asking, literally asking that question, what does it mean? And somebody in the government saying, well, maybe it does actually mean something significant. Would you be interested in, you know, looking at these alternative angles, because the Air Force is having no success in shooting these things down. Radar is in, we've got interesting radar reports, but these things are like ghosts. They come and go 1 minute here. They're like phantom-like. Would you be interested? And the secret weapon theory is not really getting borne out. We don't think it's the Russians. Would you be interested if we relocate you and your families to one location? You still get paid by your original agency, but you all have a background in this original Parsons investigation, and would you like to, you know, further it, if you like, and if you find something intriguing about UFOs in the process, great, and, you know, we'll run it for as long as we need to, because it's like 12 guys right now or whatever. Here's 100 grand for the first year or whatever, and that's how I was told, at least, that it all kicked off. So. And which is kind of a convoluted story, but I hope people understood it all right.
Well, it's funny because you and I and people we know have been fascinated by Parsons and Crowley and all these people and their possible connections to anything to do with supposedly UFOs, but specifically, I guess, the government and people being interested in them. And here what you do is stumble upon something that basically ties together a lot of stuff that you and I and God, who else? Adam Gorightly and Miles Lewis and Mac when he was alive. All these people have been kind of doing their own research and making their own connections. And here the government supposedly was doing this in the late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah, but as I said, I truly don't think it would have happened had it not been for the fact that they were investigating Parsons anyway because of this espionage thing with Israel. I don't think it was a case of anybody in the government looking at the UFO thing and thinking, hang on, this seems occult-based and it's linked with Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley. You know, that wouldn't make sense that you would think that. It was actually, I think, by default that these people were on these investigations into Parsons because of the Israeli thing, and because of part of their study, they were obliged to look into Parsons' background. And as they did so, they found all these weird links. And I think, you know, had he not stole these files and shown them to the Israelis, this group probably would never have existed.
Yeah, well, it's you know, different different paths to the same sort of interest and understanding. What just kind of floored me was that somebody would be interested in Parsons in any way connected with the UFO subject way back in the 50s.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I actually don't think the story is disinformation, because it's such a convoluted story as to how the group got set up. But if you look at it, it's actually quite... It does make a lot of sense, you know, the idea that they stumbled on it by accident almost, purely because they were looking at another aspect of Parsons' life. You know, as I said, I would be suspicious if somebody said, oh, we just decided to look into Jack Parsons because we thought the story, you know, UFOs are a cult base. It's like, well, why would that prompt you to look into Parsons? But it was more along the lines of... It sounds like you've got machine guns going on in the studio.
Yeah.
But it was more along the lines of saying, no, you know, that they didn't look into Parsons because they thought UFOs were a cult. They looked into Parsons for other reasons, the espionage angle, and then realized that he was sort of tied to certain players in the UFO field. And then that spurred them on to look into this other angle.
Wow, there's people trying to call in and ask questions. I haven't finished asking questions, but I think Paul Kimball is trying to get in. Let me see if I can get. Do you mind if he's on for a little while?
No, I don't care.
Yeah, don't you mean that you would enjoy it and welcome?
Tell him say no. I don't mind. I don't care. No, seriously. Yes, Paul wants to come on. That's totally fine.
Okay. Oh, well, I'm not sure if he can speak at this point. Let me see if I can...
We summon you to speak, Paul Kimball.
Well, he's somehow online, but... I don't know how to bring him in. Well, Paul, if you call back again, I will pick up the phone. It's just that it was making that horrible, loud, scary noise, and I don't know how it did it. Here, I'll plug the phone in again there, Paul.
I know what it is. It's them.
It's always them. I had a... In relationship to that last question, one... It's so weird that anybody in the government would be looking into this, which shows you how thorough they are. People think, oh, they're all straight laced and they're not going to look at it. No, if there's something that looks like it might bear fruit, they're going to look into it.
Yeah, I mean, government. The fact is, government agencies do fund weird groups. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example. This is absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the Collins elite or even with UFOs, but. A couple of years ago, I got hold of a 1950s U.S. Army file where the Army had literally plunged thousands of dollars into a project to try and determine if dogs possessed ESP. And if they did, they wanted to train the dogs to use ESP to find landmines on battlefields. Now, you know, it's like that in itself is sort of a very weird area of research. But it's all done, you know, because there's some sort of military gain to be found within the program in some respects. And, you know, I think with the Collins elite, particularly in later years, you know, they were viewing the groundwork was being done, certainly in the early years, to determine what was going on. In later years, I think the funding was justified on the grounds that, well, this is actually going to save the souls of the human race, so of course we're going to fund it.
Yeah, which makes you wonder, in light of this and in light of the weird things they were doing and what some people that govern might think about spending money on something like this. I mean, not to mention a remote viewing and some of the other things that people can't believe that somebody didn't say shut this down immediately until they finally did. How do you think the group has lasted so long, since apparently they're still going, without being phased out or... You know, losing their funding or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I actually think there's a very easy answer to that question. I think because they're so, you know, today at least, and certainly since the 80s, so religious dominated, because in certainly more recent years we've had more and more examples of mainstream and even fundamentalist religion playing a role in governments, that it's quite natural, I think, that the people who are pulling the strings and the ones who have access to the government budgets, etc., are going to fund something that's supportive of their belief systems. And I think that's an important issue. And I think that's where the Collins Elite made a critical mistake. Whereas in early years they were looking at alternatives to the ETH, today they've represented or presented themselves as a group that is at the cutting edge of trying to save our souls from the clutches of demons. But we need funding to keep doing that. And there are people in governments who, you know, who believe that also, you know, that everything that's going on is dictated by, you know, the battle between good and evil. So in other words, these sorts of people will fund a group like that. And I think the answer as to why they've gone on for so long really is that simplistic. When you have people who agree with you in government and they hold positions of power and they're the ones who have got their hands on the money, they're going to support you. So.
But are these people saying things that people within power in the government want to hear? I can understand during the Reagan era, which we can get into as well, but...
I mean, you only have to look at things today. You know, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that, I mean, certainly in the Bush administration, you know, the way in which religion and God was brought into the war on terror, you know, that's verifiable. And, you know, the more you get that, the more you find that anything that's sort of relevant to that is going to get support. I think it's literally that simplistic. I actually don't think there's some sort of deep, convoluted story as to how they got the funding. It was simply that they were saying things that people in government, certain people, happened to believe and accept, and therefore felt this was valid, and that, okay, we want to keep funding these guys because they're actually saying the truth. But they were saying the truth according to what, you know, certain people perceived was the truth, so...
How much do you think that enters into that group and the people that backed them and all that, that they basically had... it sounds like, you said, as you said, it got different later, but how do you think that's how it survived, that it became sort of a group of yes people to people that had these beliefs in the first place?
Yeah, I think in the early years it existed for the very same reason that groups like Sign, Grudge, Blue Book, Twinkle, and the Robertson Panel existed, that there were people in government for varying reasons concerned about the UFO subject. For example, you know, Sign and Grudge were sort of, you know, early legitimate research programs into UFOs, as was Blue Book to start with, but in later years, it did become like a public relations exercise. You know, Twinkle was focused on green fireball sightings in New Mexico. The Robertson Panel was more focused not on the phenomenon itself, but how it could be exploited by the Russians, you know, to sort of clog emergency channels and, you know, sort of sneak in a nuclear attack under, you know, but by clogging the channels with bogus UFO reports, things like that. So in other words, I think in the early years, the Collins Elite, and I think it was important to look at the era when it was created. It was created when you had these different groups, like the Robertson Panel, Sign, Grudge, Twinkle, all looking at things, actually from quite different perspectives. And I think, you know, it was a case of somebody throwing money out here and there to say, well, let's see what we can find out. And I think that's what happened with them. But I do think in more recent years, it quite literally is a case of them being almost like yes men. Now, I don't think it's a case of them cynically saying, being yes men to get money and to keep them in jobs. I think they earnestly and honestly do believe that the phenomenon is, from their, as they see it, sort of Christian-based, demonic, and that these entities represent, you know, our worst nightmares, and that this is all linked in with the, you know, the final battle between good and evil and Armageddon and return of the Antichrist, etc. That's literally how they view it, and I don't believe they're cynically exploiting that. I think they earnestly believe it. As I said, I mean, you don't have to look far at all to find you know, the way in which this is impacting on government anyway, regardless of UFOs and the Collins leads. I mean, I'll give you a good example. I mean, in 2003, intelligence briefings on the war in Iraq, which was sent to the White House by the Pentagon, were actually delivered with cover pages that quoted from the Book of Psalms and Ephesians,
right,
the Epistles of Peter. And I'll give you a good example. The cover page of a report dated March the 31st, 2003, actually for the White House, read, this is the cover page, "Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand." So, in other words, you know, we're seeing this more and more, where religion is becoming integrated in warfare. And you know, when you have people in government who believe that that's right to do so, you know, these are Christian warriors fighting against, you know, these dastardly Middle Eastern infidels. That's literally how they view it.
Yeah.
So anyone who is offering something else that adds to that story is going to get financial support, I think.
So at the beginning, they really weren't fundamentalists. They were just trying to find out what the hell was going on, but it's become that way.
They were just trying to find out what was going on, but they did realize, to their credit early on, that there were some weird overtones that suggested this isn't just nuts and bolts extraterrestrial, that there are weirder things occurring. But it seems to be from the 80s onwards that it went away from being, well, you know, this is something, it's in the early years, they were talking about very interesting scenarios tied in with Parsons and Crowley entering altered states, you know, to contact these entities. In later years, you didn't hear anything about that. You know, maybe they perceive sort of drug taking as, oh no, you know, that's a no-go area or whatever. So in other words, in early years, they were very open-minded. Today, they seem to be 100%, 110% sure of what they believe is going on, is going on. And the rest of the world, you know, eventually will be told, or will be, you know, will be in ordered to follow this belief system or whatever.
Well, I got the impression from in the book that early on they did have an open mind, but they were basically focused on the sort of the Western Christian mindset of souls, immortal souls, and souls being harvested for something or other. And that they there's no real way around it. That's a faith-based kind of way to think about it, I think. And they just...
No, you're right. I mean, the important thing, I mean, a number of the group members, you know, actually said this to me, you know, this is what we believe is going on. You know, it's like they didn't have demonstrable proof that, you know, that these things are literally demons from a hell that no one can actually prove exists in the first place. So that this was just their theory. But the main thrust of the, you know, why they view the UFO presence as interacting with us is that, and again, this is sort of belief-based. They, one of the areas that they delved into, particularly in the 60s and certainly through the 70s, much of the 70s, were relative to things like out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences.
Yeah.
And they apparently interviewed a number of people who said that, you know, they'd gone through sort of classic near-death experiences, you know, somebody has a car crash and they rush to hospital, they die on the operating table. 10 minutes later, you know, the doctors frantically bring them back or whatever, you know, with just jump-starting the heart again. And, you know, they spoke to people who had these sort of typical, if you can call it typical, near-death experiences of leaving their body, seeing the doctors working on them in the hospital room.
Yeah.
Seeing a, you know, going down a tunnel of light, etc. And a number of these people they supposedly spoke to said that they went somewhere that was sort of very ominous. It wasn't like the Christian image of hell, whether you suddenly met by this guy in red and, you know, horns and a fork tail and a pitchfork, you know, and pushing you into the fiery pit because you, you know, you once killed a bird 30 years before or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You know, nothing like that. But equally, there's nothing like the, you know, the pearly gates and St. Peter welcoming you in. What they actually said was that they went to sort of like another realm, which the best way I can describe it, because that's the way it was described to me, is kind of like the scene, or the scenes in the Matrix, the first Matrix movie, where you know, Keanu Reeves is living in this holographic type dream world, and then he wakes up in the real world, which is actually where the entire human race has been sort of grown and harvested for like electrical energy, and he's in sort of this huge factory,
right,
never-ending factory of all these human bodies in like pods. Well, that's how, that's apparently the scenario that the Collins elite got from a number of people who had near-death experiences. They said they saw what they described, or one of them used actually used this word, which the, or phrase that the Collins elite adopted, if you like. He described seeing like soul factories, endless human souls, millions upon millions, kind of in some sort, excuse me, in some sort of like factory in simplistic terms. In other words, it was sort of like a cross between a supernatural realm and a hellish realm, but one that seemed to also employ almost like H.R. Giger-style technology. That was how it looked. It was sort of like weird, just very odd alien technology, I guess. But equally, it was like a hellish realm, and they were harvesting human souls for some sort of energy upon which they thrived. And it was almost like they were described as being kind of, almost like kind of like Tulpa type entities, in the sense that they would feed on the human life force to sustain them.
Yeah.
Like a psychic vampire. And the Collins elite came to believe that that is the entire reason why the aliens, or whatever they are, don't land, or why they don't destroy us. They don't want to destroy us because they need us, and they don't want to land and say hello because there's no need to. What they actually want to do is to maintain the herd for as long as possible, because every time we pass on to the next realm, you know, it's kind of like, it's the equivalent of the farmer taking the cow to the slaughterhouse. And that they viewed these entities as having the ability to, from the Christian perspective, you know, prevent people, you know, literally going to heaven, I guess, and instead, you know, they could be siphoned off and fed upon. I mean, that is sort of the literal stark approach they had. Now, a number of people who read the book have been quite, you know, said, well, that's, you know, that's just a Christian perspective, and which is fair enough, it is. Other people have been quite disturbed, you know, by the idea that the human race, we're just literally being farmed. You know, we have our 80 years or whatever, if we're lucky, on Earth, and we're not seeing the bigger picture, that this is kind of like the field where we're munching on the grass. They don't, and we're not seeing the bigger picture of what happens after that 80 years of, you know, where we're essentially used, like in the Matrix, as a battery, you know. But, my, you know, all I can say to people is that, you know, don't go sort of running out and slashing your wrists or whatever. I mean, this is a belief system generated by people who, in many cases, are also already Christians or even fundamentalists.
Right. That was one of my questions. But it depends on what period of this group you're talking about. And the question was, did they strike you as fundamentalist or just trapped in a cultural tunnel?
This is why I don't think it's disinformation, because I think it does say quite a bit about the legitimacy of how the human mind works. That, you know, if this group in the 40s concluded it was all, you know, good versus evil, heaven and hell, and that scenario being kept in place for years, well, you know, that's interesting, but I would expect the more that data came in, the more that views and ideas and theories would alter. That's one of the things that I always find suspicious about the MJ-12 story, going back to the 40s to today. It's so simplistic because nothing ever changes. The views of the people don't change. Bolts aliens coming from Zeta Reticuli to abduct us. Well, in any intelligence gathering field, ideas, beliefs, conclusions change the more intelligence data you have. You know, some of the simplistic UFO scenarios don't change. And I think that's why this isn't disinformation, because it has changed over, you know, half a century. And I think that's indicative of the fact that more intelligence data has come in, and they've modified their conclusions and beliefs. But the important thing is, to what extent that intelligence data is valid and genuine, or is it belief-driven? You know, that's the thing. And I think a lot of it in more recent years is belief-driven. You know, it's almost like backing up a scenario they've already got in place. and discarding anything that doesn't necessarily uphold that viewpoint.
Yeah.
But it is a very disturbing and weird story, but it's no weirder than, as I said, really, you know, the military funding a project to try and train dogs to use psychic powers to find landmines. You know, I mean, I got hold of other files, for example, on the CIA's search for Noah's Ark. I got files out of the British police force in the Second World War used dowsers to try and find bodies buried under the rubble in the cities after,
right,
you know, Hitler's bombers had bombed England. So, you know, governments fund and investigate weird shit. That's what it comes down to. It doesn't necessarily mean it's always valid or it's always reasonable, and sometimes it is. And I think that's the same thing with the Collins elite. It was a weird group with weird beliefs that got funding. But at the end of the day, should we say that's amazing, or should we say, bearing in mind everything else, so what, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, reading the book. One, people will ask you, well, God, do you actually believe this? And two, you know, because I've had people say that about certain things I've written. I say, well, not really. I don't really believe in anything. I've got an agnosticism about it all. And as long as you keep that, I think you get some more information. How much did doing this book really affect your views or beliefs about the UFO thing, or was it just kind of another weird little Donnybrook that you investigated?
It's probably, I mean, I don't lie awake at night worrying that I'm going to be turned into a battery for demons or whatever like that. You know, I'm not trying to be, you know, sarcastic or anything. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. But from my own perspective, I actually, somewhat ironically, do, as someone who is not personally particularly religious, but only because, you know, I don't know the truth. You know, I find it difficult to accept anything on faith, you know, and so it's not me targeting religion or a religion. You know, it's just, I find it difficult to accept anything on faith. But where I do agree with the Collins elite is that I have, like a lot of people who have been in the UFO field for after a while, I've come round probably in the last 10, 12 years to the idea that the phenomenon isn't literally extraterrestrial. And where I also agree with the Collins elite is that I think it's manipulative and deceptive, and can our perceptions of it change, of its appearance over the years, you know, depending on our cultural perceptions and prejudices, etc. And
yeah,
I think there's evidence that the manipulation is more for their benefit than ours. However, saying something's not extraterrestrial, but it's potentially malevolent and manipulative, and it may not be for our benefit, is a far, far different thing from then concluding, well, that means they're demons from hell who are going to steal our souls unless God saves us, you know, when Armageddon comes. You know, that's the leap I cannot take. So in other words, I think, you know, we could be talking about other realms of existence, which arguably, you know, some people would say heaven and hell are. But the problem I have is with most religions is the very simplistic things we're expected to believe. You know, oh, well, if you did so much bad, you go here, and you do so much good, you go there, and somebody's keeping note of everything. And, you know, mainstream religion is less about teaching people or discussing concepts relative to whether something survives bodily death, and it's more about controlling people through fear and guilt. And that's what, you know, mainstream religion does. So I wouldn't say it hasn't changed me at all, you know, and I don't sort of worry about this scenario. I find it a fascinating scenario, and I find it fascinating that government agencies have investigated it. But, you know, I mean, it's like if somebody tells me, you know, they channeled some entity from Venus last night who said a meteorite's going to hit the planet on August the 17th, or nuclear war is going to break out on January the 4th of next year.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. You would drive yourself crazy if you worried about everything people told you that had sort of a dark side relative to it in ufology.
Well, people actually do that.
Yeah, well, they do. But again, you know, it's kind of like, it's the same thing. Fear and guilt are very easy tools to control people.
Yes.
You know, fear, when something goes wrong in the world, people get frightened, they turn to government. And there are people who have personal prejudices over, you know, whatever it is in life. You know, whether it's your attitude to alcohol, drugs, sex, or whatever, doesn't matter. But they will try and manipulate you to feeling guilty about, you shouldn't be doing this, you know, that's wrong. Well, you know, that's your version of wrong, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in other words, fear on the one hand and guilt on another, they're very powerful tools, and religion does an extremely good job of using both.
Yeah, some forms of mainstream religion. At least the ones we're very familiar with. Another thing I found fascinating in the book that kind of floored me was basically what was sort of a tulpa-based explanation for Roswell. Not really tulpa, but like a manifested something or other that was made to drop near Roswell in 1947 and not actually some alien craft, but something designed to make us think so. And this was something that the group had seriously considered as a possibility.
Yeah, well, this first came via Ray Beauchamp, and I probably wouldn't have even delved into this area with the group because it wouldn't have occurred to me had Ray not discussed it with me first. But he told me that when he met these guys from the Department of Defense in 1991 in Lincoln, Nebraska at the hotel, they told him that yes, the Roswell incident was real and it had nothing to do with, you know, Japanese balloons and prisoners of war, nothing to do with Mogul balloons, nothing to do with weather balloons or V-2 rockets and monkeys, but equally nothing to do with aliens. But they said it was a genuinely anomalous Fortean event. Now, you know, the one of the main reasons why they included the whole abduction scenario was like holographic is because, according to biblical teachings, demons don't have a physical form. You know, they're almost like an energy, which, interesting enough, is the same with jinns in Middle Eastern lore. You know, they're kind of like a non-physical energy, like a plasma, if you like, in simple terms, but an intelligent one. And so, in other words, you know, they shouldn't be able to physically interact with us in terms of having, you know, flesh and blood bodies or literal nuts and bolts craft. And so then Ray said, well, how is it then possible, if this theory is correct for the UFO phenomenon, how is it possible that debris and bodies could have been found at Roswell if these things have no sort of physical corporeal form? And what Ray was told and what I was sort of further told was sort of what is actually a very intriguing and interesting story. They said that Roswell wasn't like a landing, wasn't even a crash. It was like a literal deceptive Trojan horse where the event was made to look like a crash, you know, a staged event as a means to kind of secretly inform or have the U.S. government believe that literal aliens had fallen into their hands, you know, and it would be like, wow, these are extraterrestrial entities and they've crashed and this is their craft, etc. Now, what Ray was told and what I was told was that the debris itself was kind of like a demonic alchemy, that these demonic entities had literally, you know, had the ability to go to some other, who knows, solar system, galaxy, whatever, pluck matter, manipulate it into the form of sort of bizarre metal-type materials, and then literally just let it fall on the desert floor. And as far as the bodies were concerned, the way they described them was kind of like extraterrestrial jackalopes, you know, a jackalope being sort of a non-existent creature made from different body parts to look like a real creature. You know, you actually see a lot of these in Texas where somebody will take like a, you know, a stuffed body of a rabbit and they'll stick a pair of deer antlers on it and something, and like a crocodile's tail. You know, it looks, it's just people having them around their homes, you know, it's just sort of like a little, you know, thing to look at and talk about or whatever. But they concluded it was the same thing with the bodies, that the bodies, or body parts as they described them, they said, this is an interesting thing they said they found from allegedly studying classified files on Roswell. They said that there were no bodies found at Roswell. There were body parts. And the body parts were essentially DNA that had been, I guess, manipulated and remolded and re-sculpt it in the same way they said that matter was to create the debris. And so, in other words, body parts and materials are deposited on the Foster Ranch, and then the conclusion was that, you know, the military comes to the conclusion it's extraterrestrial. And what the group members also say, which is, again, kind of interesting, is that explains why there was no sort of power plants, no, you know, in simple terms, no antimatter engine or tripod landing gear or anything like that.
Right.
It was just a case of weird foil and bits of flesh and things, because it was all simplistic stuff re-sculpted. Now, what's interesting is that they sort of drew parallels between the creation of the bodies and the legends relative to the golem of Jewish folklore, you know, the idea of creating an animate life form out of inanimate materials,
yes,
and matter. What's interesting is that one person who Jack Parsons was very close to, and who was almost a father figure to Parsons, was Theodor von Karman, a notable rocket expert. It just so happens back in the Middle Ages, one of Theodor von Karman's relatives was someone who claims to have conjured up a golem. So in other words, you know, that was another reason why they made this tie-in here, that yes, Roswell was an anomalous event, but it was like a Trojan horse / demonic event.
Yeah. It's the other part
which
of this...
Which is utterly silence.
Huh?
Go on. I said which briefly utterly silenced Greg for a second then.
No, it did, because I'm listening to you, and then I'm also trying to... I'm looking up my next question here and seeing what's a good good lead-in. Well, see, Nick is good at radio interviews, because usually he'll have to say a couple of sentences or talk for 30 seconds or a minute and then go on to the next question, bam, 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 bam. However, on this show, I let people go on. Unless they're becoming boring, I let them go
tedious.
On as... Huh?
I said it's less of becoming tedious.
Yes, as you say, tedious. I will let them go on. And Nick, as far as I've been able to tell, and since I've known him, has never put me to sleep or been tedious. Another part of the book that was neither tedious nor boring was the kind of delving into. And this is, you know, when you're reading the book, you think, "Wow, when is he going to get to?" And it's the subject of abductions and military people showing up in them. And some of the stories that are in there related to that, as in that one woman that was abducted, then she got back in the car and she said there was some worried-looking military person sitting on the driver's seat next to her. And there's a lot of these around, and I think there were a few different versions or belief systems or whatever you want to call it, ways of looking at it that the Collins Elite people chose to, you know...
This is an important point that I mentioned in the book, that, you know, the Collins Elite held these beliefs, but I don't think they were the only group that held them. There are other groups that look into very similar areas. I mean, I talk about one point in the 1970s where apparently a professor, a theologian, was approached by some group in the government who wanted information on whether, you know, the whole UFO subject could be demonic. But the weird thing is that everybody I spoke to in the Collins Elite said that was actually nothing to do with us. That was somebody else. We're not sure who it was, but we do know that there were other people following similar paths. Now, you know, given the fact that they spilled the beans on a bunch of other stuff, to me it seems illogical that they would just deny this one particular story as not being relative to them. You know, it kind of makes more sense that this was a similar group. I mean, another classic example is the very famous 1973 helicopter case involving Captain Coyne.
Yes.
Where, in Ohio, where this helicopter crew saw this UFO, which essentially sort of bathed the UFO in a green light. Well, you know, this is sort of like a classic, a really good early to mid-1970s UFO case. You know, you have the whole crew of the helicopter seeing the craft and experiencing sort of technical malfunctions that made the helicopter rise into the air and then drop down again. And what a lot of people don't know, though, is that in the wake of the incident, Coyne and several of the other crew members were phoned by people identifying themselves as being in the Pentagon, asking whether, in the wake of the experience, they'd had weird experiences like out-of-body experiences, did they have any dreams of dying and things like this. And two of them actually did. Now, again, nobody I spoke to knew anything about this, and they said they'd never seen anything in the files that they'd read about the college elite being linked with the Coyne affair. But somebody was asking Coyne and his crew questions very similar to those that the college elite were asking other people. So, you know, I think it's kind of like wheels within wheels. You know, there are people investigating stuff, not necessarily knowing somebody else is doing the same thing. Now, for example, Ray Beauchamp's people, they never mentioned the name the Collins Elite. And, you know, ironic, one of the ironic things could be, even though that it was Ray's information that allowed me to get on the trail of some of the other people, I'm not sure this may have been sort of some tandem-type group, because the Collins Elite, their ultimate conclusion was that, you know, this is all satanic, demonic, and it needs to be stopped. There were people in the group that Ray spoke to where they almost wanted to sort of enter into like a Faustian pact with these entities to understand their technology, even if it was like an occult technology. Now, no one in the Collins Elite ever said to me, you know, we felt like we needed to bargain with these entities to try and get the upper hand and understand their technology. It was like, no, you know, we need to try and stop what's going on, not interact with it. But some of the people in Ray's group, it was the exact opposite. So, you know, granted I'm theorizing and speculating here, but I think some...
Nick? Can you hear me?
People have probably looked at this, you know, if it's the fight between good and evil, maybe we can actually exploit them to work against people, you know. And that says a lot about human nature, I think. You know, that's why, again, another reason I think the story's real, not disinformation, because it has a lot of psychological elements to it, the way we think, regardless of whether you wear a uniform or you sit in an office in the Pentagon or at Langley. It does have a lot of issues connected to it that are relative to the way human beings think and change and, you know, mold ideas into their belief systems.
Well, Nick, that's just what they want you to think. You know that.
Well, that's true. Yeah, they just keep you running around and all the time. You know, there's aliens at Area 51 eating strawberry ice creams. Which them hype me.
There's another story in there, and it involves Rendlesham that really fascinated me, and that the claim from, I don't know who it was from, maybe you can refresh my memory, that it was some sort of psychotronic holographic technology, which you did go into a little bit earlier, that was being used not by the I can't remember whether it was by the entities that they're talking about or some sort of branch of the government that actually, one, would control people's perceptions of what was going on, and two, would leave physical traces of these perceptions, even though the thing that they were seeing didn't actually physically exist as we understand it.
Yeah. What it basically was that certainly by the early 80s, as that Dr. Mandor said, certainly by the early 80s, there were people in government who concluded that while abductions were very real in the sense that the people weren't lying and they weren't imagining things, that it was kind of like, not so much, I won't say something in the mind, because that's actually very misleading. It was like a holographic image. You imagine kind of, the best way I can describe it, you imagine lying in bed, and the next thing you know, you're in a huge room. Well, it isn't a case that, you know, with an aliens are prodding and poking you. It wasn't a case, as I was told, that the government or the Collins elite concluded this was a dream inside your head. It was almost like you were interacting with some sort of semi or quasi-fluid hologram. You know, it was like it was a hologram, but you could actually interact with it. And reported, a lot of research had been done on this phenomenon from the mid to late 70s through certainly the 80s. Now, right in the middle of that, of course, you have 1980, December 1980, when the Rendlesham Forest case occurred.
Yeah.
And the story was that at least some research had been done into this field of holograms and even interactive holograms, where the hologram itself you know, or the person's perceptions would actually alter the way the hologram appeared. Now, I know this sounds science fiction-like, and the science behind it, we just don't know what it is. But the story about Roswell being sort of like a holographic deception to try and determine how the troops would respond, this actually didn't come from anybody in the Collinsville. This came from Ray Beauchamp's two sources. They literally told him this. One of the reasons being that back in the mid-80s, Ray, who had a deep interest in the Rendlesham story, actually approached his senator,
Exxon?
I think Exxon, that's correct, yes, Senator Exxon, and, you know, lobbied to try and get material and data on Rendlesham released. And, of course, you know, this meant what happened was that Ray attracted the attention of officialdom. And these guys basically said, well, you know, yes, something strange did happen at Rendlesham, but it's not what a lot of people think. And they said that it was basically one of these hologram-type experiments, essentially not just as much to test the weaponry technology, but also to see how it would affect the people.
Yeah.
And, you know, would they fall for the ruse, if you like? And, of course, they did, hence the fact that we've got, like, 9 or 10 books written about the entire subject. But they said that this technology was utilized at Rendlesham, and it was done in sort of like a safe environment in the woods on the fringes of a military base, so it was all kept very much, you know, self-contained. And the idea was to see how it would interact with the personnel and, you know, how their brains would interpret it. Some people would see one thing, you know, some people would see like a triangular-shaped object, others would see a ball of light. Some said they got messages from aliens, some said they got messages from time travelers. In other words, it wasn't them simply making up. Their subconscious was actually being sort of ripped out of their heads as a means to determine the way in which the phenomenon would appear for each individual person.
Right.
And that was essentially the scenario. But why it got highly disturbing was because even though this was supposedly just theoretical, nothing was ever put into practice, the scenario they had or envisioned was, you know, could this holographic technology be used to sort of, you know, instill in everybody's minds the imagery of Jesus or God in the skies, you know, coming back, and everybody then would have a deep Christian belief system, which they actually felt that the stronger the Christian belief system, the deeper our ability to hold these entities at bay. So it was kind of like creating a false flag deception from their perspective to do a greater good. You know, the human race needs to be deceived via sophisticated holograms that God and Jesus have returned. And they all get behind it and believe it.
Yeah, our deception is...
these entities.
Yeah, our deception is better than yours.
You can find online a lot of stuff about this, you know, the idea of using holograms, you know, to create some sort of false flag scenario. But what was interesting is that, you know, although, you know, people say, well, why did you put that in the book? You know, that's just like X-Files type stuff. But the important thing is that the people I interviewed said that the stories that you see on the internet... you know, that sort of talk about, you know, this whole idea of false flag, you know, type things. They said he actually didn't go any further than, you know, just talking about it in sort of a round table type scenario. If you go on the internet, for example, and type in Project Bluebeam, that's supposedly the name of a project within the government to sort of create a new world order by projecting sophisticated holograms into the sky of, you know, the second coming, and, you know, it'll create a new world order that's sort of ruled by an iron fist of religion. Everybody I spoke to said the Bluebeam stories are nonsense, absolute nonsense, but they are built out of what was just literally a very small round table kind of discussion, and nobody actually knew how. Somebody must have leaked it out, they said, that allowed these Bluebeam stories to flourish, but the original story was just like a theoretical concept. Well, you know, could we actually fake a religious event using this holographic technology?
Yeah.
By focusing it on people who have a deep religious belief system? You know, and it was just a discussion like that. That was it. Everybody I spoke to said, you know, the idea that there are countless satellites in space with sort of holographic beaming technology is just nonsense. It's just like paranoid Commander X type stuff is just, you know, just complete crap.
Of course, that's just what they want you to think.
But there was something, there was like a roundtable discussion saying, well, if we did this at Rendlesham, we provoked alien imagery. You know, if we did it outside of a church, what would the result be? It was kind of like along those lines.
Well, they could also look at the work of Michael Persinger, who was getting people to see religious and NDE experiences by bombarding their heads with different electrical and electromagnetic fields. So, and that was in the 70s. The other thing that brought to mind when you said that, and I don't know if you brought it up in the book, was that this messengers of deception, literally, thing that you were talking about was suggested in the late 70s in the book Messengers of Deception by Jacques Vallée, which leads me to believe he's either sitting at that round table or knew somebody that was.
Sorry, Vallée knew somebody, do you mean?
I said the fact that he wrote about this very scenario.
Oh, okay.
And warned about it in Messengers of Deception leads me to believe that, would lead some people to believe, that either he was sitting at that round table or knew somebody that was.
Well, I mean, I personally don't know anything about that, but what I do know for a fact is that Ray Beauchamp's two sources did actually comment specifically on Messengers of Deception. They actually did say, and I put this in the book, they actually said that Vallée was pretty much as close to the truth with Messengers of Deception as anyone's ever got. But whereas Jack kind of concluded that this was potentially human manipulation, they said that his biggest mistake was the origin. But, you know, they basically said that everything else, you know, the deception, that it was being done to influence the human mindset as a means of control, you know, they said that was all absolutely correct. But they said he was just wrong on the source of it, you know, where he sort of viewed the intelligence agencies and cults, etc., as doing it. You know, they concluded it was demons. But they said, in principle, everything else, you know, the means and motives and modus operandi, etc., you know, he was spot on.
That would make sense. In light of the fact, how many emails and letters have you gotten over the years saying, we are going to expose Jacques Vallée as being an agent of disinformation, this and that. I've been getting those for 10, 15 years now.
Well, I'd have to say I've never got one along those lines.
Really? I've gotten a few, like four or five different ones.
Yeah. I've never got one like that, but what I have got is, you know, correspondence where people have said, you know, a lot of people, you know, when we've just been talking in general, actually, you know, do believe, you know, that the idea that the phenomenon isn't what it appears to be. I think the big problem, and, you know, this is one of the things that I get mad about with ufology, is that there are certain people in the UFO field who uphold the ETH purely and simply because it's good for business.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other scenarios get stifled. And so, in other words, it's kind of like these ideas, they're not fringe ideas, but they get pushed to the fringe.
Yeah, they're more fringe than aliens.
Yeah, I mean, Messengers of Deception is one of the most important UFO books ever written.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people recognize that, but it's almost like I see people in ufology at conferences, they kind of squirm that they think it's a great book, but it's not necessarily supportive of the ETH, which is vital to their business or whatever.
Well, it's vital to their business and to their belief system and all their friends and the whole thing they have built up around the UFO subject, which is one of the things I'm going to talk about at this at the Wake Up Now conference, about basically demolishing and getting rid of UFO organizations, which would be a good thing for ufology.
Yeah, I mean, mainstream ufology as groups and conferences really isn't any much different for people going to a church on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
You're preaching to the converted, and you... Yeah. And most conferences are themed around a particular belief system. Now, I mean, to their credit, last summer, I lectured at the annual MUFON conference in Denver, Colorado, and my lecture was on crop circles, but not from the perspective that aliens were doing them. I talked about the ties between the human beings that were making them and the fact that many of them were tied to things like ritual magic and entering into altered states to make them. And, you know, it actually went down very well. I got a very respective response to it, so I was pleased about that. But mm-hmm. there are a lot of groups, a lot of organizations, and publications for whom the ETH is good for business, and really, you know, if you're not towing the party line, they don't want to know. Or maybe they want to know privately, but publicly, yeah. you know, they don't want somebody there talking about Aleister Crowley and Lamb. They want somebody there talking about Area 51.
Yeah, or, you know, how many planets could alter support life and how quickly they could get here, etc.
Well, it's 77. It's 77 planets, and it's 36 yeah. minutes.
Oh, okay, good. No, it's instantaneous, man.
Aliens told me.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Then that must be right. I will. There is. I will talk shop with you on one thing here, mm-hmm. because I wanted to. And I didn't want to do. I wanted to do it publicly for the people that are listening. There's a piece of information in the book, in Final Events, the book we're talking about here, about something referred to as a meeting that took place at some place called Loftus Boat.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Can you describe what that was? Because I'm not sure I remember what it was. It was some sort of. It was a Collins Elite meeting, like a roundtable dinner meeting.
Yeah, actually, a number of people asked me, you know, have I managed to find out anything else about that? And I actually haven't. It's sort of a strange story, but it basically this relates. Most of the documents that I've referenced in the book have all been declassified under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. Uh-huh. I mean, for example, a lot of the group members provided me. With official documentation that I was able to subsequently confirm it surfaced by the FOIA. For example, like literally hundreds of pages of files on Jack Parsons. I've probably got a file, probably 5 inches thick, I'm not exaggerating, of FBI, CIA, State Department, etc. files on Parsons, which mention Crowley, which mention the Church of the Lamer, all sorts of things.
I've got a few of those too, but I'm sure you've got a much bigger stack of them by now, because I got these, I don't know, 10 years ago in the midst of a bunch of other things. All it described was
you also know from the book, you know, I've reproduced official documents how the Collins Elite supposedly had approached Ruth Montgomery, of all people, you know, to get her views on UFOs, and actually got hold of the official files after they told me that, you know, we spoke with these people, and the files do talk about people in military intelligence approaching Ruth Montgomery and saying, you know, tell us about your views, etc. Yeah. But the one document that you're talking about that mentions this thing called the Loftus Boat was actually, I guess, like an unofficial document, and it's supposedly titled the Collins Report, which I actually have quite a lot of pages of, and it's a fascinating document that I reproduce one of the pages, like a facsimile of the document in the book itself, and the text of probably 7 or 8 pages, and probably 4 or 5 years ago, no, sorry, less than that, probably 3 years ago when I was writing the book, I sent some of the copies to Patrick Wiege, the editor of the book, separate copies that aren't reproduced in the book because, you know, there was some we were just basically limited to. But the story of this thing called the Loftus Boat, it talks about May 1998 meeting at a place where they had a round table dinner at what was called the Loftus Boat to discuss the various theories and conclusions and how the future was going to progress and what needs to be done to keep these entities at bay. Now, what the Loftus Boat is, you know, I have no idea at all. I have to be truthful on that. And I could not get any answers from anybody. The document was supplied by one person who said, well, you know, what's in the document is up to you to research it further and find it. You know, we're presenting it for what it is. Uh-huh. But what it is, you know, that's still, you know, if you type Loftus Boat into Google, you find the only thing that kind of crops up is some company that makes boats that I think one of the people's names is Loftus or something like
yes,
that.
Yes,
it clearly has no connection there.
It's a company in the UK that makes boats.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what it's a UK.
Yeah, I looked it up and he said, I've never been able to find anything on it. So I typed it in. It's like, oh, well, maybe it has something to do with the boat company. Or The thing I thought was that the aviary, if you want to, whatever you want to call it, Bill described to me a meeting they had once, not on a boat, but on an island in the middle of a lake. And the reason they did this is because they could control who was listening, because you can't really listen to people out in the middle of an island in a lake. Mm-hmm. And two, you could control who was there. It was a very small island, and all it had was a picnic table on it with a roof over it. And he said they all went out, and they all took rowboats or something out to the middle of this lake and met on this island and talked for about an hour. So I was thinking, well, maybe...
that's interesting.
That
is kind of similar, actually. I mean, you know, it would make more sense that you'd be, you know, if you want a meeting, let's have it out on a boat in the ocean. I mean, this is speculation.
Yeah, you know, I'm just speculating,
maybe there's somebody in the group named Loftus who had a boat, you know.
Maybe that's it. Who knows? Or it's an acronym. But
if you read that document, you know, it's not... it's kind of written in sort of like a stilted type style. It's quite clear that the document's written for members of the group. It's not like the Eisenhower briefing documents.
Right.
Which is written from the style of briefing someone who knows nothing about the subject.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it is. This one is clearly intended for people who are already aware. It's like
It's written in a shorthand for the people that were there, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. And so from that respect, you know, there arguably would be no reason to elaborate on what the Loftus boat was, because everybody would know. And for example, I mean, one specific paragraph talking about the Roswell angle, it says, this writer assumes Collins' elite awareness of STAC reports, STAC, that describe the fall collection analysis and present whereabouts, etc., etc. Now, there's no description of what STAC, STAC means. Had it been prepared for somebody who had a requirement to know, it would clearly say, you know, STAC, as I point out, could be science, technology, something like that, but it could be something else. But the very fact that it doesn't specify that in the document, to me, does suggest it's not intended for people who aren't already in the know. So.
Sorry, I'm just waiting for the sirens to go by. It is not Radio Mysterioso without sirens. Oh, here comes another one. Here you go.
Excellent.
It is not the authentic Radio Mysterioso without the fire engines going by the studio very close.
It's a Collins elite.
What?
It's a Collins elite.
Yeah, they must be. I must be doing something real important. Before we go, because I don't want to keep you up too much past your bedtime, I had one other question, and that was, has there been any reaction, like critical reaction, UFO group reactions, government insider reaction, reactions from the people who you interviewed?
I can talk about all that. I mean, in terms of the UFO research community, the thing is, within the UFO research community, you know, you have some people who know nothing about the Collins elite, but who do believe this theory, you know, that it is demonic. People like Guy Malone, Michael Heiser, Joe Jordan, people like this, who I interviewed quite extensively for the book. And, of course, Ray Boucher. So from that perspective, you know, there are people in the UFO field who... they didn't agree with all the Collins elite group's theories, and they, you know, they didn't agree some of them with the idea that the human soul can be extracted and manipulated, and some of them, you know, were against the idea of, you know, the fundamentalist approach. So in other words, they were amenable or open or even fully accepting of the general theory that, you know, it's demonic. There are other people who felt it was purely and simply disinformation. But my view is, you know, why present disinformation when the people as disinformation, when the people who are doing so are clearly pointing out that much of their conclusions are belief-driven? You know, if you want to disinform someone, I would think you would try and really convince them you have hard evidence of something rather than you've developed a belief system, which is essentially what I was told. You know, this is what we think's going on. By the way, we're all fundamentalists. You know, to me, that doesn't sound like disinformation. That sounds like regular human beings having a belief and then incorporating their beliefs into this. Now, there have been other people who essentially felt that it wasn't just disinformation to sort of steer us away from the ETH, but it was disinformation put out, regardless of whether they church to the UFO angle, disinformation put out to kind of veer people more around to like a fundamentalist belief system in general. You know, kind of scare people, use a scare tactic of demonic aliens and have them go run into their churches in simple terms. But, you know, as I pointed out, there's no disrespect to Patrick Weege at the publisher. You know, Final Events is published by a print-on-demand company. It has no face, you know, in bookshops. You have to order it online. You know, print-on-demand means it's not published until people order the copies. So, in other words, I'm pretty sure that, you know, because the people I interviewed knew I was writing the book, you know, if you really want to get a scare tactic out there and convince and manipulate a massive amount of people, why approach an author when the book actually doesn't have shelf space in the shops? Do you see what I mean? It's like you're almost kicking yourself in the teeth. You know, it's like the book isn't going to reach a million people. So to me, that kind of makes me wonder, well, why even go down the disinformation path anyway? Why not approach someone whose books sell a million copies, and then everybody would know about this theory, and you know it would have a substantial effect. So, in other words, I think the people really did speak to me purely and simply because I spoke to Ray Beauchamp about Rendlesham, and that opened up the entire rest of it. And then I tracked them down, and they decided to speak. I don't think there was some bigger agenda. However, you know, a lot of people who've read the book do think there's a bigger agenda, but it's quite clear from the tone of some of the emails I've received that they're getting quite defensive because it has a negative impact upon the ETH. And that's clear, you know, from some of the emails I've got. It's like, you know, how could you fall for this? Well, number one, I haven't fallen for anything. I point out at the beginning of the book that, as I point out, specifically and literally in the book, you know, this is a belief system of the group in government. And I'm relating what this group believes. It's not my conclusions or my story. I'm just relating the story of what I heard and was told.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so people have got kind of defensive from that perspective. You know, how could you say this? Why have you changed your views? Why are you giving a
blah, 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 blah,
people?
Blah. Well, that's but like
you,
saying...
You know, usual crap you get.
Yeah, that's like saying if you that's like going to Adam Gorightly and saying you're a Manson family member because you wrote about the Manson family.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
yeah,
I'm reporting on it.
Yeah,
I'm telling you what I found out. Doesn't mean I believe it just because I say something. Do you have the concept of a disconnected report on something?
Yeah,
I would hope that's what you're doing every night on the news, listening to what you hope is disconnected reporting on something.
No, you're right. And I think, you know, this you get this a lot, not just in ufology, but in all of Fortiana. Whereas if you write something and you tell a story, by default, you're seen as promoting and championing that story and believing in it, rather than, you know, my view on the Collins Elite story, the reason I wrote it is because I truthfully do believe, and literally, you know, it came to me as soon as I spoke to Ray Beauchamp, that it was a fascinating story.
It is.
That the group in the government, being a think tank type group, rather than a huge agency, but think tank type group, being funded to look at the idea that UFOs and alien entities could have demonic origins. You don't have to believe in it to recognize that if the government's funding something like that, it's a great story from an investigative journalistic perspective.
Yeah.
And that's how I try to treat the story. And I think that's how it should be treated. And I think every aspect of ufology should be treated like that, but it isn't. They're all treated as belief systems. And then when you kind of knock them or you say something different, a lot of people just cannot get their head around it's possible to write about something because it's fascinating, not because you're trying to hammer home it.
Trying to convert people.
Endorsing it as fact or whatever.
Yeah. No, I find that too.
Oh, it doesn't bother me because I just don't have the time or the inclination to waste on dealing with it. You know, people, I'll reply, but, you know, it's like there's only so much you can say when you've got to work and whatever, you know.
Well, that, and it's a sometimes it's a rat hole, because you will say or try to explain what you're doing, and it has no effect on people, and it's just kind of a waste of time to talk to a lot of people that are just basically coming at you based on a belief system.
Well, that's the thing, you know, the big problem is we know there's a phenomenon, we're not sure what it is, so inevitably that creates belief systems, and that is the same with religion, with ghosts, with Bigfoot. You know, the idea that Bigfoot is a surviving Gigantopithecus is a belief system. In the same way, the idea that the Loch Ness Monster is a plesiosaur is a belief system.
Yes.
You know.
Because there's no objective way to... Yeah, there's no objective way to prove any of this. Even the Collins Elite story, which is ostensibly just the story of a bunch of people with a belief system.
Well, that is all it is. You know, and people say, well, is it important? And my view is, it's important... from the perspective that the government is investigating this angle, that's what makes it a fascinating story. But I will be the first to admit that whether or not it's important that people conclude UFOs are demonic, and that, you know, is it important, you know, because the people outside of government that have concluded this for years, and that's not a big story. You know, people like Guy Malone, they believe it, but they're not working inside the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So... Is it really that important that there are people in the Pentagon who believe it just because they're working in the Pentagon? Or should we just treat them as like, you know, an average member of the public who, you know, somebody might think, well, the idea that they're demons, you know, could be plausible. But that's not a story. That's not news. You know, the idea that government group funds $1 million a year to investigate demonic UFOs is news.
Yes,
but it doesn't mean it's any more valid than the fact that John Smith, who lives two doors down, thinks that demons are aliens. So.
Well, it might, because if they use that belief system to influence public decision making, then it becomes a little bit more of an important story. And so far as you've been able to determine, it's not really gotten to that point yet. But like you said, it's an important story.
That point has been discussed. The idea of it's kind of like we know best, and, you know, if we can actually keep these entities... They came to an interesting conclusion that belief or denial of these entities actually has an effect on the extent to which they're able to interact with us. In other words, if you open your mind and doors, metaphorical doors, you can let them in. If you have a deep belief system that can keep them out... it will literally keep them out. Now, you know, how they prove that and what the science and the concepts are behind that, I don't know, but that was their view.
Yes.
But then they went down the disturbing path of saying, well, you know, if people's beliefs can keep these entities at bay, we need to further bolster those belief systems. How do we do that? Well, if we come up with some sort of charade to where everybody actually does believe it, then, okay, we've deceived people, but on the other hand, we've just saved everybody's souls. So, you know, it's almost like a religious fascism that we know better.
Yeah, and you said one of the people actually left the group because he did not agree with forcing people into a belief system.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, he was one of the people who was sort of in the... He certainly wasn't in the early years. He was sort of like 70s, 80s, but I think he was in early enough to see the last stages of it being an open-minded study of alternative theories to the ETH, and the one that almost got hijacked by, you know, the fundamentalist angle to the point where it just got crazy. And he walked away, I think, because he wasn't of that mindset. And more importantly, he'd also seen the previous mindset, which had kind of worked at a more acceptable and logical level, if you like.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I think he believed the soul stealing thing, but he said, I'm uncomfortable with forcing it upon the population.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's an important aspect. You know, it's kind of like religion does that. You know, I mean, I'm not targeting one religion or another, but, you know, your parents take their kids to church at 4 years old or whatever, and the kid is indoctrinated. The kid is not said, this is, you know, this is interesting data, and try and understand it, and, you know, let us know what you think. No, they're indoctrinated that this is fact.
Yes.
And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, in a simple fashion, it's kind of like stories of Santa Claus. You know, you are told there's such a person as Santa Claus when you're, like, old enough to understand. And for years, millions and millions of children all around the world believe this because it's been successfully instilled in them. Now, you know, this is just a simplistic thing of no importance, really. But it's the same kind of thing. But where you grow out of Santa Claus, you don't grow out of the stories of Adam and Eve and the apple or whatever. Now, you know, it's not my place to say it's wrong or right, but I do think it's everybody's place to say you should, if you're going to be taught this, it should be taught theoretically. It should not be taught as hard fact when there's no hard fact to support it. It should be, here's the data, make your mind up.
Yeah. Well, you would hope at a certain point, but, you know, how early do you start telling kids, you know, here's a bunch of data, make your mind up? I guess as early as possible.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, kids aren't stupid. You know, it's like, you know, kids quickly work stuff out, you know, what different things mean,
yeah,
what they imply, whatever. And, you know, I think the big challenge is, with any religion, it should be, if you want to find out about it, that's fine. And if you don't want to find out about it, that's fine too. And if you believe there's a heaven and a hell, that's fine. If you believe in reincarnation, your karma or whatever, or if you believe you get your whatever span you've got, 20, 30, 60, 80 years, and after that, if it's lights out, it doesn't make you a bad person. It just means you hold a different belief system to somebody else.
Yes.
But when somebody starts saying, like the Collins elite today, apparently, you know, we know this is what's going on and this is what we have to do to save people. Now, you know, the interesting thing is that their belief system, which have got more sort of extreme in this angle in the last 10 years, this has also been at the same time when we can see these demonstrable things of,
Nick,
you know, the whole issue of church and state not being connected, etc.
Okay.
Now, whether or not the Collins elite are playing a role in that, or whether it's just the mindset, you know, that this is the battle between good and evil or whatever, you know, it's. But we are seeing that develop in tandem at the same in the same time frame.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you can say it's just a reflection of basically what's going on anyway, the intolerance that's building and that how that just it's cascading down into all different areas, including this Collins elite, you know, to the detriment of most people. Although I guess most people will never hear about this group except through this book.
No, well, I mean, you know, people haven't heard the Collins elite name, but I mean, you know, I think the important thing is, I'd be more suspicious if somebody had if a group had approached me and said, this is the story we'd like you to tell, you know, because that's almost like a specific plan. You know, the fact is we can trace a story back to Ray Beauché, who met these two guys in November 1991.
And he never really said anything about it till you brought it out of him.
Not really. I mean, it was mentioned in a couple of books, but, you know, we're talking about half a page or something like that, or a page about the Rendlesham angle for the most part. But the important thing is, you know, that had I not approached Ray on the Rendlesham thing and then we expanded into different furthers, I would have never have gone on the trail of the group.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's an important thing. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, why the group is speaking out, some of them I know is purely and simply because they're not happy with the way it's progressed.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, again, that's a valid point. You know, you start something off 30 years ago and you see it change into something else. You know, and I part of it is the fact that maybe to see what the initial reaction is, you know, somebody said to you, why didn't they go to the New York Times? Well, maybe they will. But the point is, what a lot of people forget is the UFO research community is a small body of individuals, you know,
yeah,
a couple of thousand. It's very easy. You get somebody to put a story out like Final Events, and then you carefully monitor the radio shows, the magazines, the book reviews, etc.,
mm-hmm,
to see what people are saying. It's easy to build up an imagery of how 2,000 people respond in the wake of the publication of a book than it is to try and get a worldwide or countrywide perspective on a column in a new, in, you know, in a major newspaper or whatever.
Exactly.
Because you can target them, you can watch them, you can see the feedback between each other, how they interact, are they hostile to it, are they accepted, etc. And I think that's probably what happened here, that, you know, well, let's put the story out, and we've got the perfect group. You know, we can target them, we can watch them, they're small, and they're easy to watch, you know. So I think that when I got into the story and started knocking on doors, I think that's what happened. It was like, well, he's got the basics of the story from Ray Beauchamp. Let's put it out there and let's see what the response is. And, you know, the response, I think, may dictate what happens, you know, if things progress, etc.
Yeah, well, the response is, so what you've described to me is exactly what you and I and most people I would have, we could think of, would have thought it would have been.
People don't want to hear it.
Yeah, they don't want to hear it, or if they are excited by it, it's too much of a minority to have anybody make big deal. But the thing is that they don't know. They don't know this. They don't know the audience, maybe. And maybe everybody would be surprised at some point when some, you know, who knows what's going to be a hit. It just suddenly hooks up with a bunch of people. And this may happen yet with your book. I don't know. I hope it does, I guess. I hope it does.
Well, you know, I mean, I think most UFO books do not break outside of the UFO research community.
No.
You know, if that was my, you know, if my goal was to, you know, just break out of this or break out of that, you know, I'd have stopped doing all this long ago. I put it out for people who I hope will find it interesting. And if they're inside the UFO community, which for the most part they are, that's fine. If it occasionally, you know, spills over into other areas, well, that's cool too. And I actually do know that with Final Events, you know, it has spilled over into other areas. I've seen it mentioned on, like, end times religious websites and things like that.
Yeah, that's have you had any Christian groups?
Spilled over like
has it, have any Christian groups asked you to come speak yet?
No, they actually haven't. But I have actually got quite a lot of emails from people in sort of the mainstream religious communities who, you know, do believe this theory is the correct one. You know, I've not had anybody in the religious movements say, I've spoken to people in the Collins elite, although I have had other people come forward and say, you know, as I said, one of the interesting things at the beginning of the interview was that, you know, I was told the Collins elite was a nickname. But, so in other words, the name of the Collins elite, no one else so far has given that to me. However, I probably have received at least 30 or 40 emails from either members of the public who maybe have known somebody who was sort of linked with a group like this, or some retired military people, even eyewitnesses to UFOs in the military, who said, you know, they were asked kind of questions similar to the ones asked of Captain Coyne in 1973 after a UFO incident. You know, did you have any, like, a near-death experience? Did you feel you'd visited heaven or hell? That sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do think there's, you know, the sort of the level of response is sort of what you would expect. You know, it's kind of along the lines of just general human response, you know, to situations and stories.
The one other thing that kind of startled me reading the book was, you and I both know that I've been pounding on, I don't think the government knows much more than we do. And I still kind of think they don't. But I was surprised, if true, about the methodical way they went about interviewing people. Like, and asked them how it affected them afterwards, and how it affected them emotionally and psychologically. And did you have these kind of dreams? Did you become more interested in Buddhist philosophy, all this? UFO investigators, civilian ones, never ask that stuff.
No, you're right. And I think what this does suggest, you know, again, is sort of this thing that you would see, that, you know, you'd have a sort of a typical military operation like SIGN that wants radar reports, it wants pilot encounters, it wants, you know, soil samples, that sort of thing. And then you have, you know, the CIA guys on the Robertson panel sort of weaving and creating all these complex sort of spy scenarios of, you know, well, can the Russians, you know, clog our intelligence lines, which, again, you know, this is totally different to, you know, asking about Buddhism and stuff like that. But it is evidence of military people asking the sort of questions that, for the most part, civilian UFO researchers wouldn't ask. You know, they wouldn't, a lot of civilian UFO researchers wouldn't go down that path of whether or not the Russians would be able to manipulate the phenomenon by, you know, clogging emergency services, saying there's UFOs everywhere, and then launching a sneak attack. So in other words, the military does often think outside the box in a way that the UFO research community doesn't. And I think these sort of questions that people like the Collins elite were asking of witnesses is, again, and it's, you know, it's another example of them perhaps being a little bit more open to the open to the idea of thinking outside the box, because there's a realization that thinking inside of it hasn't really got us that very far. So.
Yeah, and they thought of this in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing, too.
Yeah. But then again, you know, you can also look back in the 70s and look at things like remote viewing, you know, the government studying ESP as a form of espionage.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, those army files using training dogs to use ESP, they're from like 1953.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in other words, I think often what we think, oh, this is cool, groundbreaking stuff, somebody's actually been doing it for far longer, you know.
Well, Nick, I think I'll let you go to sleep now. It's almost 12:30 where you are, so.
All righty. Well,
thanks so much for being on, and I hope there were some questions here that you didn't get asked before about the book.
Oh, yes. Very few people have asked me sort of about Mandor and some of the weird specific stuff like, you know, the Loftus boat, where you were able to then sort of dovetail that in with Bill's story, which, you know, kind of now does make me think it possibly was something like that, you know, where a meeting under circumstances where the chance of anybody else finding out about it was slim because of the location or whatever. So,
yeah.
No, that's, we covered a lot of good new areas. So.
Well, excellent. Like I said, I read the book and I expected one thing, to see a story about a bunch of fundamentalist Christians who are completely focused on one area and trying to force that on everybody else, and then realizing, no, this story is a lot more variegated and has a lot more history than that. And there are a bunch of things in the book that are surprised me, and Nick found out, you know, in contrast to a lot of UFO books, really, that just tell you about some things you already knew about, maybe a new twist on it. This one actually introduced whole new ideas to me, and I appreciate that, and I think people should order that book. It's called Final Events, and you've had another book released since then, right? The NASA book.
Yeah, that's the NASA Conspiracies, which is like a study of NASA's involvement in the whole UFO phenomenon. And well, not just UFOs, but it covers things like files I got through the Freedom of Information Act showing how the FBI had investigated the Challenger space shuttle disaster to see if it was sabotage, and they'd interviewed a contactee who said she'd been told by the aliens that the shuttle was blown up and all sorts of weird stuff.
Well, we're going to have to get that one on the next show.
Alrighty. Well, thanks again for having me on the show, Greg. I had a good time, and keep me posted of what's going on.
I will, and you do too, and I'll talk to you soon, show or not.
All right, cool. Sounds good. See you later, Greg.
Thanks, Nick.
All right, see you later. Bye.
Good night. That wonderful hang-up noise in Skype. Nick Redfern, the book is called Final Events. Final Events and the Secret Government Group on Demonic UFOs and the Afterlife. That is the full title. By our good friend Nick Redfern, who can be, his writing can be seen at UFO Mystic on a nearly daily basis. And you can also go to nickredfern.com to find out about his other books and his research. It's Radio Misterioso. We'll be back next week. Mr. Fab is coming again to play some weird music. And speaking of weird music, how about a song called, oh, I mentioned this at the beginning, Skellykins. This is also off that Nashville Sputnik compilation.
Funny things to me. Hiding in the backyard, skeletons, skeletons, hiding in the chimney. sitting in the chimney and nobody else can see. I'm scrunched way down in the garbage can so the skeletons can't get me. Big black phantoms hiding in the backyard, vampires in the tree. I'm hiding in here with the corn cob in my ear and Worcester cheer chire sauce running down my knee. Ooh, them vampires is what's mean. I better take another swig of moonshine. Trash can waiting for a trash man. Wish it was an ash can rather than the hash can. Sitting in a pile of corned beef hash can really set you free. Skeletons, skeletons hiding in the chimney and nobody else can see. I'm scrunched way down in the garbage can so the skeletons can't get me. Big black phantoms hiding in the backyard, vampires in the tree. I'm hiding in here with the corn cob in my ear and Worcester cheer chire sauce running down my knee. There goes those goat riders in the sky, and I'm all wrapped up in yesterday's menu. Here come the fruit.